Technically Legal, Technology and the Law, Done Right, Podcast 3. Hi, I'm Dominic Rabie, and with me today are...
Ben Snitkoff.
And David O'Brien.
Today we'll be talking about three topics: trademarks, online harassment laws, and journalists on Facebook. Let's dive in right into our first topic, trademarks. In this topic, we're going to be covering two sorts of cases: Google AdWords cases and the Apple iPhone App Store cases. First, Google's AdWords program. Now, Google, as you may know, is the world's largest and most popular search engine. And the way they make money is they put advertisements next to searches that people run. So basically, if someone runs a search, they see advertisements that pop up alongside based on what they've typed in that they're searching for. So if I'm on Google and I type in dog food and search, I'll see on the right that I've got dog food, natural dog food comparison tool, all sorts of interesting links that pertain to dog food that are paid by the advertisers who pay Google money based on certain keywords. For example, this particular ad that comes up for dog food, that advertiser said, I want to display this ad when these words are typed up, and the particular words, in this case, I searched for dog food, so they matched those words. These are called keywords. And these keywords correspond to advertisements. And where the trademark situation comes in is, suppose you're searching for a particular brand of dog food, and you search for the name of that brand. And let's say that this brand of dog food is called Yummy Dog Food, and I search for Yummy Dog Food. But suppose Yummy Dog Food has a competitor brand of dog food that isn't as yummy. Let's call it Meaty Dog Food. And Meaty Dog Food goes to Google and says, hi, Google, we'd like to buy ads that say, buy Meaty Dog Food, it's yummy, whenever someone types in the name Yummy Dog Food. In other words, when people are looking for Yummy Dog Food, we want ads displayed for Meaty Dog Food. This is basically called initial interest confusion in law. And basically, in a broad sort of summary, it means I'm looking for one person's product, and because of that interest, my initial interest in that person's product, I'm then drawn in to being confused or drawn to another person's product that isn't the person's product that I first sought, but is rather a competitor. So how Google has dealt with handling this sort of thing is they've said, all right, if you're the owner of a trademark, if you have the word yummy protected in the domain of dog food, because all trademarks sort of are scoped, they only apply to certain categories of things. So you can't usually trademark a word across everything so that anytime anyone uses that word, they have to talk to you first, especially for words that might be dictionary words. But you can, however, trademark words within the context of a certain product. For example, yummy for the purposes of dog food. So what Google's done is said, all right, if you're doing a search on this word and you want and you own this trademark in a particular area, then come to us and say, hey, we got this trademark. We don't want anyone else buying advertisements that pop up when people search for this word. So yummy dog food could go to Google and say, hey, anytime someone searches for yummy with relation to dog food, we don't want any meaty ads. We don't want anyone else's ads except for our ads to show up. And Google can opt out of selling advertisements for yummy dog food. Now, this case, the Soaring Helmet v. LeatherUp.com case, goes a little beyond what you might normally see in a Google AdWords trademark case. In this case, the people suing Google, they sent Google a little letter that said, we want this trademark to be opt out. It was recently filed just June 9th, and they sent the suit, that is, and they sent Google a letter, and Google complied. They said, all right, we're going to get rid of all those uses of your trademark for anyone else, but they are still suing Google. And Ben and Dave, do you have any thoughts or insights into this case? Why, even though Google has already removed the ads, they still are trying to sue Google? What might they be trying to accomplish?
They could easily be looking for damages in a case like this. They have at least a plausible argument that while there was this while their competitor was advertising using their name, that they suffered some sort of monetary damage. People who were looking for their product ended up finding the competitor's product, and those people bought the competitor's product instead of their own. And there's a reasonable claim for damages there. I personally don't agree with the law behind the claim, but there's a legitimate argument that they have damages that can be recovered.
Well, from a legal perspective, I think up until this point, it's been a little bit unclear as to whether trademark law should even apply to these types of lawsuits. Is this something that we really want? Do we want people to be able to sue on the basis of what a search engine like Google can do with key search terms? And if we want to get into the nitty-gritty technical legal portions of the actual lawsuit itself, I mean, to have a violation of trademark law, you generally need to have a what's known as a use in commerce, which means that the use of the alleged use of the trademark term in order to constitute some type of infringement must be actively used in commerce. And it's a little unclear up until this point whether or not this is qualified as a use in commerce, meaning using these words on a search engine like Google. And so it could be that some of these people are interested in seeing some sort of legal doctrine actually be established one way or another.
Another important thing here is that not only does the use have to be in commerce in conjunction with selling a good, it has to be what's called trademark use of the good. It has to be used to identify the good. One of the things that was alleged in that complaint was not just that the competitor was using that trademark in their advertising, causing the initial interest confusion, but specifically they weren't using it in a competitive form. So one of the exceptions to trademark law is that if I'm advertising some store brand shampoo, I can say, compare this store brand shampoo with Head and Shoulders, and that's what's called competitive fair use. I'm using it as a, I'm not trying to identify my good as Head and Shoulders shampoo. I'm saying this is similar to Head and Shoulders shampoo. If you like Head and Shoulders shampoo, try my less expensive form of it, and that's perfectly legal. In this case, the plaintiff was specifically alleging that the use that the competitors were using it to say, you know, we are selling this product, we are selling this, our competitor's product, that they were not actually selling.
I think you're right. I think they wanted to get away from the idea that there was any type of implied sponsorship between the two different entities, you know, meaning the mark holder and the person who was purchasing the actual key terms to use for the purposes of searches.
Sounds good. Do we think that Google will sort of, I mean, they've gotten a lot of lawsuits like this in the past couple of years that they've been running AdWords, and AdWords is sort of the cornerstone of how Google makes money. Do you think that they are going to try to handle these similarly, or try to, I'm sure they've come up with a policy, but do you think that they want to, I mean, I guess the cease and desist policy where people can opt out is how they're handling it right now, but that doesn't seem to have been enough for this particular plaintiff. Like, what can they do to stop things before people even need to sue them? I guess could they say, "Hey, this is a trademark," when someone's buying ad copy before anyone tries to opt out?
Well, Dominic, can you explain a little bit more about the opt-out program? I mean, do you know how it actually works? Do they have a repository of trademark terms that Google kind of keeps watch on when people indicate that they don't want their terms to be sold?
The way I understand it is that basically it happens when someone comes to Google and says, I have this word, I own this word, here's proof of the trademark of this word, and I would like that you don't sell any ads, AdWord ads, on this word within this particular product domain.
So in other words, it seems that there's a pretty clear way that a mark holder can already come forward almost as a preventative measure before
right.
any of his marks have actually been sold, and request that Google not allow these to be sold or commercialized as search terms.
Correct.
I mean, from my opinion, is that from a business standpoint at least, that seems like a fairly effective way to do it. I don't know if it is the most legally efficient way, and I certainly don't know that filing lawsuits is an efficient way either. But like, you know, like I sort of mentioned before, at the same time, these suits are a little unsettled because we don't really know in the end what the ultimate outcome would be of if a suit went all the way through. I think there have been a couple of other suits that have sort of failed on this use in commerce issue up until this point, at least until recently when we had the RescueCom case. So that sort of, I think that might go into some other areas. Do you guys know if there's any, how this case might be distinguished from some of the other trademark cases that we've had?
Well, as far as the RescueCom decision goes, my understanding is that before the RescueCom decision, it was the law pretty much everywhere that Google's sale of trademarks constituted use in commerce, except for in the Second Circuit, where the RescueCom decision came down. The RescueCom decision then reversed the Second Circuit's previous jurisprudence, kind of, and made it so that everywhere Google's sale of AdWords, at least on a motion to dismiss, could constitute a use in commerce. As far as...
So in other words, that doesn't actually say one way or another whether it's an infringement, but it just allows on sort of procedural legal matters for the case to continue on past a motion to dismiss.
Yes, and it should be noted that the motions to dismiss it's a very low standard that you have to hit. Essentially, the court looks at this first document that you file. It's called a complaint. And the court assumes that everything that you say in the complaint is true and then decides whether or not, based on those facts, you're stating, you know, what's called a cause of action, something that you can sue on and recover for. It's a pretty low bar to hit.
So basically, the only thing really different about this suit is that they're trying to go back before they actually opted out and say that they were damaged because they didn't take action on their own part. Do you guys think that's likely to prove successful in court?
It seems hard to do that without the notice factor in first. If you're going to say that before any type of notice actually occurred from the mark holder to Google, that there was some sort of damages that had already occurred, you know, the law tends to recognize good faith actions on the part of potentially infringing people, in this case Google. And up until the point where there was no notice given, and it went up until the point where there's actual notice given, I think that marks the sort of transition period of the good faith intentions of Google. And when looking at what they did, they certainly tried to mitigate any types of damages they had by, you know, acknowledging the fact that this person does in fact own the mark, and they went through and removed all uses of the mark as much as they could from the search engine itself. And as far as we know, beyond that point, they have not further sold that mark as a key search term. So I don't really know that, you know, there is necessarily much to the suit, as far as I see it, beyond the ultimate issue of whether or not these are viable suits in the end. If we want to look at who's actually going to prevail in the end.
Yeah, another important consideration in these types of suits is that in this specific suit, the plaintiff was suing both the person who posted the offending advertisement and Google. Google is not the kind of company that's going to really want to see a decision one way or the other in these cases. I doubt that Google would risk getting an adverse decision in one of these cases out of the fear of the flood of litigation that would result. I think Google would be much more willing to make a series of small settlements than to have an adverse decision in one of these cases.
That makes perfect sense. So it'll be interesting to see how these cases develop, and we'll certainly keep an eye on them. But for now, it just looks like most of them are probably going to eventually go to settlement or not make a big difference over Google's current policy. Moving on to the other trademark case that we're looking at this week, the Apple iPhone App Store provides applications for iPhone users that they can download and use on their phone. And Apple approves every single application that goes on the App Store because they want to make sure that only applications that are legitimate, legal, and that don't do anything against Apple's own policies or that don't damage people's iPhones, because they want to make it a friendly, usable experience. Now, there is a game out there called Edge, made by the company Moby Game, and it was quite popular on the App Store. However, Tim Langdell, who owns the trademark Edge, asked Apple to remove the game, and Apple did so. And the grounds that he asked for the removal was trademark infringement, because he owns the company Edge Games, and he felt that the game named Edge by another company, Moby Game, would infringe on his trademark Edge. And Apple, before even resolving the suit, they sort of preemptively said, we're going to take down this game while we sort this out, so that no one can download that game, at least while it's called Edge. That's pretty much the summary of that case. Tim Langdell apparently has a rather lengthy history of using his Edge trademark against people in various circumstances, or he's defended his trademark in various circumstances. But I'd like to sort of consider the broader issue here of just the App Store and how Apple uses that as they're the gatekeeper for everything that goes on the App Store. A little more background, developers pay about $99, I think it's a yearly fee, or it's $99 to get the SDK, the software development kit that runs on a Mac and enables them to develop software for an iPhone. And then once they develop software, they submit it to Apple, and Apple approves it or doesn't approve it. And if they approve it, then it'll appear in the App Store where developers can either provide it for free or they can charge a fee. And then Apple takes, I believe, 30% of the revenue, and developers walk away with the other 70% of the revenue. Do you guys have any thoughts on the legal implications or anything that might be interesting about the fact that Apple has set itself up as the gatekeeper for the entire App Store?
Well, maybe, but not necessarily. I mean, you have to sort of realize that to the extent that Apple is actually filtering the types of applications that are available for their iPhone and their iPod Touch, they are also concerned about contributory infringement matters. So they need to worry about becoming some sort of distributor of something that might potentially be infringing another person's trademark. And that basically means that they're not the actual entity that is doing the infringing act, but they're sort of contributing to it by allowing it to pass through their distribution system, namely in this case the App Store, out to customers, or which are the holders of the Apple devices themselves.
Makes sense. What about the fairness of removing the game while trying to figure out whether the claim that the trademark is being infringed or not is legitimate, because people downloaded the game and now if someone else wanted to get it, they can.
The Apple iTunes App Store has never really prided itself on fairness. Whose perspective are you looking at, though? The perspective of the mark holder, from whom I imagine he thinks it's very fair, or the perspective of the game developer?
Perhaps. I mean, there could have been like some sort of just renaming the game, or maybe that would have been too detailed and that perhaps the name is throughout the game. I mean, for example, I couldn't go download the game to see what the game how much the game actually used the trademark Edge, because it's not available on the App Store.
Well, you know, when it comes down to it, why does the game developer want to rename his game? He has spent all this time, and as far as I know, I've never actually used this app. I'm not an iPhone owner myself, but it seems to be a fairly popular game, and I did, you know, go to their website and sort of check it out, and it looked pretty interesting. They put all this time and resources into making the game and sort of establishing a name for the game. Why should they be forced to change the name in the end of the day? And when some guy is coming forth with a claim, which in the end we don't know, but it might not even be legitimate.
Yeah, Ben? I agree. You don't want to change the name of a product like that just on a whim, especially if there's some amount of goodwill that you've already developed in a product. If I developed an app and I, you know, had a name for it and people downloaded and started saying good things about it, I would be very hesitant to change the name, because then if somebody shows their iPhone to their friend and says, oh, look at this great app I have, that person who's being shown the iPhone won't be able to find my app under the new name. And there have been a few apps even that I own that have had to change their names for various trademark reasons, but it's not great for the person who made that application.
It sort of stinks, but in the end, you know, this is Apple to some extent doing this. We're going to act first and sort of ask questions later. And you know, you got to remember, Apple's not a court of law or anything. They don't have any sort of legal authority to decide whether or not this is a legitimate trademark claim. Someone comes to them and says, "Hey, someone is infringing my mark, and they're doing it through your App Store." Apple's going to do the smart thing that their lawyers probably told them to do, and that's they're going to take that app right out of the store for now, and they're going to wait till the ultimate outcome of the case before they decide what, if anything, that they're going to do with the actual game itself.
Makes sense. So I guess Apple will probably continue to take the path of least risk, which is what we would expect them to do. And if a game developer or any other app developer wants to use a name for their game, they should probably do a little bit of due diligence and see if anyone owns a trademark on that particular word to avoid this sort of awkward circumstance where their game is put on, it's very popular, and then it's yanked while the situation is resolved.
Yeah, that raises an interesting issue, though, because a lot of these app developers aren't people with any type of business experience. One of the most popular iPhone apps when it first launched was a game called Trism, and that was written by a guy who had no previous business experience, had very little software development experience before then, and was raking in money hand over fist with this. So the average developer isn't going to have the... what's the word I'm looking for? The knowledge,
financial resources,
the knowledge of financial resources, the business acumen to know to do a search for that, or even to know
to even think of it.
Yeah, or even to know what terms to search. I mean, you can go on the trademark site and search for marks, but it's not a very detailed search. It's not a very robust search. If you search for Edge, you'll find all of the ones that come up with Edge, but you have to look for other things that could be confusingly similar to Edge, too, as far as look and feel of the mark. So it's a lot for a little guy to do, especially when they're not familiar with it, and hiring a lawyer to do that kind of thing would be prohibitively expensive.
Especially if they don't even know if they're going to make any money with their app in the first place.
Right.
So.
And those are very sort of nuanced legal standards. I know as sort of we step back and we put on our layperson's hats, and we think about trademark law, it seems like it's a very simple thing. As a layperson, we might think that, oh, hey, you're not allowed to use, the logo or some sort of image that's associated with another person's product. But in reality, like the legal standards that do actually get applied are much more complicated. And even from the lawyer's perspective, when we put back on our lawyer caps and we're looking at whether or not a claim might actually succeed, there it's very gray, and the court considers a lot of different factors. And we might paint people with a brush and call them trademark trolls, but sometimes you just don't know what's going to happen.
Makes sense. So that's pretty much our trademark sector. Now moving away from trademarks, but still in the area of confusion and similarity, I guess some states have passed online harassment statutes, particularly. Texas has passed a new bill that makes it a crime to impersonate people online, specifically just creating, it's a felony in Texas, and this has been passed by the legislature of Texas, and as far as I know, signed by the governor.
Not yet, I don't think.
He's going to sign it, or she.
It's on the governor's desk, I believe.
Okay, it's on the governor's desk. It makes it a felony to create phony profiles on social networking sites with the intent to harm, defraud, intimidate, or threaten others. And it basically says that a social networking site is any site that allows people to register, to communicate with others, or make profiles. This law seems incredibly broad to me.
I agree that it's broad, but I think it's fairly well crafted in that it's saying that you can create a phony profile as long as it's not with the intent to harm, defraud, intimidate, or threaten others. As far as those go, defrauding people, intimidating them, or threatening them is not something that's protected by the First Amendment. Harm is where, at least in my opinion, they're going to come into trouble, because I can make a phony profile for Weird Al, and as long as it's parody, it should be okay, but harm is kind of nebulous. I could do harm that is protected by the First Amendment through parody, because parody is protected by the First Amendment. So there is a chance that it's unconstitutional, but I think it will hinge on how they define harm. Is it economic harm? Is it intentional infliction of emotional distress? Is it some harm that's recognized by a tort?
I think you've pinned this issue very correctly, mm-hmm. and that's the harm factor is incredibly hard to lock down unless they have a very precise definition written in the statute, and even then, statutes tend not to like that. They like to err a little bit on the side of ambiguity because. You want to sort of be able to apply the statute to unforeseen circumstances in some cases. And, this is a criminal statute. It's creating basically an unlawful action, and it's punishable as a felony. So for over a year in jail by the definition of a felony. And what do we actually consider harm to be in the end of the day? I mean, I kind of get a little harmed if I read a... unsavory comment that's on a blog or something like that, that's posted after a blog post or something like that. Even if it wasn't directed at me, sometimes I feel a little emotional harm from that or something like that. Is it pecuniary harm? Does it have to be related to some sort of financial loss? I think that it becomes vague, and we have to remember that the First Amendment, you know, gives us a lot of power. I mean, it has its limitations. It's not like we can go out and express ourselves in ways, in any way possible. You know, it has definite limitations on it. But at the same time, you know, we need to sort of strike this balance between what we're allowed to do online and what we're probably not allowed to do online. And I think that's where the statute sort of gets in trouble a little bit. There was, in fact, a few years ago, I just found this out today, I think back in 2005, Texas actually had another statute that dealt with online harassment and cyberbullying, and the issue did come up through the court system in a case, and it was appealed, and I think it went before the Texas Court of Appeals and was struck down because it was too vague, unconstitutionally vague. And sort of this vagueness principle says that you need to put people on notice with your statute of what exactly is an unlawful action and what isn't. And the risk there is if you have a statute that's too vague, as we might very well see with this harmful element of this statute that we're now talking about, is that, you know, it's too gray and people don't know what exactly is harm, and so you could easily wander into the area of what might be unlawful under the statute.
Right, and courts look down on restrictions on First Amendment. They will construe them very strictly against the state. They'll strike down. So even if under this statute I were to defraud or intimidate somebody, if I were to make a profile with the intent to defraud or intimidate someone, things that are clearly not protected by the First Amendment, I could still challenge this law as unconstitutional because of the ambiguity in that harm statement, and I would have a good chance of winning because the court isn't concerned with whether or not what I did was illegal. They're concerned with whether or not this law will have a chilling effect on speech online, and courts are very reluctant to uphold restrictions on the First Amendment, the right to speech.
Do you know, Dominic, I'm sorry, not Dominic, but Ben, do you know how the statute actually defines fraud, too?
I don't. My guess is it's common law definition of fraud, which is make a false or misleading statement upon which the other party relied on a false or misleading statement that would reasonably be relied upon on which the person relied to their financial loss.
Oh, that was a mouthful. Thank you. It would. It might also seem too that it's a little hard for some people to ascertain what exactly might constitute fraud. I mean, could fraud be that you stumble across some sort of fake profile online on a social networking site, and you had some sort of belief that the person, you know, the fake profile was in fact genuine, and that the statements that were made on there were true, and perhaps it constituted some type of fraud.
But I guess so. That seems like a very good analysis to me. But I mean, you can't impersonate people in real life. Like, I can't go around saying, "Hi, I'm Ben Snitkoff," when I'm not. So why should you be able to do it online? I mean,
I don't think
I think we're. I'm sorry. You want to go ahead, Ben?
I don't think the question is whether or not you should be allowed to do that online. The question is whether or not the statute is written in a way that would allow or prohibit that. If the statute just said you can't create a phony profile with the intent to defraud someone, I don't think anyone would have a problem with that statute.
But the word harm in there is making it broader, which brings in First Amendment considerations, which could invalidate the whole statute, is basically the nutshell of your argument.
Right. And I also think there's some ambiguity in social networking. You defined it earlier as any site on which you make a profile with the for the purposes of communicating with people.
Yep.
I'm pretty sure I do that on Amazon. On Amazon, I have a profile, I have a wish list, and that wish list is for the sole intent to communicate with friends and family as to what I'd want to have for, you know, my birthday, for Hanukkah, for, you know, graduating from law school.
Yeah, it seems like it would be any site, at least the way I read it, it seems like that's particularly broad as well. Anywhere that you sign up online becomes a social networking site, which is... I mean, social networking is a buzzword that really only appeared in the last 5 years or so. We didn't really have a concept of a social networking site 7 years ago. As far back as I can remember, I mean, Facebook came out in 2004 and Friendster was 2003. So before then, I don't really think social networking was on anyone's radar, really, in terms of the websites. So,
well, let's be real for a moment. I mean, fake profiles can be fun. At the same time, they can be harmful in some ways, but they can also be pretty funny because they take, in some cases, famous figures, celebrities, or whatever, and they create, you know, these fake worlds that they live in. One that comes to my mind is fake Steve Jobs, who was a guy, and it was later revealed, I think, in the last 2 years or so, who he actually was. But for an extended period of time, no one knew who he was, and he would write these blog posts in sort of the mindset of being Steve Jobs, and he had funny ways of referring to some of the other major figures in the technology field, including Bill Gates and Mark Zuckerberg, who's the Facebook founder. And, you know, it was very comical to read, and I think it had a bit of comic relief to it. And it wasn't all bad. And, you know, we do want to promote those types of things, I think, because I think they're creative endeavors. And I think they still can sort of contribute and can, at the same time, provide perhaps critical commentary of certain people and maybe their policy standpoints. But, you know, how the statute goes about defining what is prohibited and what is permissible is that area that we want to focus on here. And we want to make sure that these laws really aren't impinging on, you know, our ability to continue creativity on the internet.
Makes sense. I guess an important thing to note, or maybe it's not important, the fact that fake Steve Jobs never really pretended to be real. I think he was pretty clear about being fake. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I believe so. I mean, even if you read the posts, you know, any reasonably intelligent person could have probably figured out that this is not actually Steve Jobs doing it, just by the way he was referring to things.
Okay. Well, and sort of as a final note, there's a website out there called the Internet Advocates Watch List for Ugly Laws. It's netchoice.org/iawful, and this is also in the show notes. And they kind of keep track of what they consider awful internet laws across the entire country. They've got quite an interesting list, and they're going to keep an eye on it. So if you're interested in this, you might want to check out their site. Moving on to our final topic, journalists on Facebook. Recently, there was an Associated Press reporter who had a comment on his Facebook page, and this apparently triggered the anger of union officials. And the Associated Press apparently has ethics guidelines and that are murky in this regard. And I guess with reporters on Facebook, I guess they add their friends, and it suddenly becomes an issue in terms of whether they're reporters when they're on Facebook or whether they're just your average Joe or whether they can invoke reporters' privilege or not.
Right. I mean, there's an interesting point here, which is if I'm a reporter and I'm on Facebook and I'm writing a story about some minorly famous person with whom I'm also a friend on Facebook. Yes, we don't think that friends on Facebook necessarily carry much clout, but it would raise some issues of bias if I'm friends on Facebook with the subject of one of my stories.
Well, in the end here, what is the ultimate question? There might be two issues as I see it. We could look at, has traditional media sort of changed to the point where everybody who is able to contribute content online now, because user-generated content in all sorts of forms is, you know, very easy to do and very cheap to do. And also looking at traditional journalists as they're sort of making this transition from traditional print media, meaning like magazines and newspapers and those sorts of things, and sort of creating a second world online where they are actively commercializing their content online. And if you think back to years before the internet had really become popular, a lot of these traditional media journalists had a much different role in society, and the interaction that they had with their readers was almost solely through their columns. And the way that people knew them was only pretty much by the way that their name was at the top of a particular article. And now it's much easier to figure out information on journalists you know, just through a simple Google search online. And moreover, people have sort of opened this new door into allowing people to interact with them in a new way online too. And certainly we see this with Facebook. I mean, a lot of the people on CNN, after every story that they do, will actively say, come check us out on Facebook. And they give you, you know, some sort of URL or a way to find them on Facebook or another other programs like Twitter and sometimes even MySpace, I guess. And you can find them on there and sort of interact with them with comments, and occasionally they will interact back with you with comments. And, you know, that whole role has sort of changed now, too.
Mm-hmm. I guess the interesting thing, at least to me, is that what used to take place in real life in in-person, real-world interactions that weren't recorded, that weren't on the record, are now, these conversations are now taking place in digital media where everything is recorded by default. A private message sent to someone on Facebook could theoretically be subpoenaed if necessary. Twitter is a very public conversation. If I tweet back at someone in a non-direct message, the whole world can see what I'm saying. So in some sense, people need to be more careful about what they're saying, but because the whole conversation has shifted over onto these digital media, people feel just as free as they feel in the real world, and they don't necessarily realize that everything they say is being recorded forever.
That's right. The data never really dies in the end of the day. I mean, once it's out there on the internet, it's pretty much out there for good. It's sort of the basic nature of the internet.
Absolutely. Though we may have gotten off the rails a little bit from the initial thing, initial gist of the story, which is, you know, this reporter was reprimanded for posting something on Facebook. One misconception that I think it's fair to clear up is that when people say something online and, you know, are, you know, shut down because of it, or if they're kicked off of a site because they made too many inflammatory comments, people very often scream, you know, First Amendment rights, you're violating my First Amendment rights. I think it's important to note that First Amendment rights do not extend past the government to the people, be that the federal government or the state government. I don't have, if Dominic were to, you know, tell me to shut up and cut off my connection to this chat right now, I wouldn't have a cause of action against him. I wouldn't be able to sue him for violating my First Amendment rights to free speech. It's just not something that applies to private parties. It only applies between the government and the people.
Right. And I guess to get back much more on track here, what seems to have happened is that the AP group themselves, meaning the Associated Press Company, went ahead and sort of took reprimand actions against this particular journalist. And it's really more of an employment issue. I think it sort of opens this up into these other questions that we sort of got off on a tangent. But, you know, they had a policy, and we have to remember that journalists themselves are very much a professional entity, like doctors and lawyers and accountants and so on and so forth. And they have standards that are generally recognized that they need to adhere to. And when you work for a company like the Associated Press, it's also the case that, you know, you might have an actual contract at issue. In some cases, employee policies can affect themselves as a binding legal contract, meaning that the employee has to abide by a particular set of rules that has a contractual remedy at law if they violate those policy terms. And it seems to be that sort of what happened in this case. And I think in the end of the day, you know, this is where we open up into these other questions. Well, should these journalists sort of get the same protections that they might get out in the real world also online that sort of protects the types of things that they say? Do you guys have any thoughts?
I'm good.
I'm good as well. I think it's going to be an interesting part of the law to watch, especially as more and more conversations go online and as the entire newspaper industry itself goes online.
I think it's a very open question as to whether we should give people that like to say things online and contribute content online. You know, in some sense, everybody is a journalist now. I mean, everyone has a blog almost, and everyone is freely available for a very low cost to go on and get their content out there. But as the law has sort of recognized it, does that make them traditional journalists and stuff like that? I don't know, and I don't think we have an answer here immediately. And maybe at some point in the near future, we will have an answer.
Sounds good. That's all we have for this week. So if you ever have any thoughts or comments or suggestions or ideas and you'd like to drop us a line, you can send us an email at podcast@technicallylegal.org. That's podcast@technicallylegal.org, and we'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.